Please be seated. Wasn't it wonderful to have the donkeys with us? It was wonderful. And I don't know the answer to your question, I'm sorry. So, climate change, affordable housing, SBCA, living wages, affordable childcare, LGBTQ2 rights, substance use, child poverty, plastic in our oceans, anti-racism, cyberbullying, food insecurity, violence, homelessness. These are some of the injustices that we care about, that we become active with. When injustice touches our own lives, we can become involved because we want to make a difference. And so it sort of goes like this. Connections are made with like-minded people. There's information sought and shared. And then there's a moment when the energy builds and the decision is made to do something more, to raise the profile of the issue. Discussions can center on ways to effectively challenge those in positions of power, how to motivate system change. Sometimes the decision is made to organize gatherings or even a march. Experienced activists are recruited and strategies created, banners made, chants learned, and speakers chosen. And it begins. In the last century, we saw how protests helped with the social fabric. They enabled the union movement to gather strength and take effective action. We saw the suffragettes fight for women to be declared persons and then to get the vote. And we have seen the implementation of universal health care. And one of the things we need to remember about all those activities was people of faith and churches were involved. They were there. Today, protests are a familiar sight. Communities of concern are emerging as a force for change. And I just think back to not all that long ago to the global protest of school children on climate change, organized from a school child of about 12, and her endeavors went global. And I'm delighted to say that students from our own Christchurch Cathedral School were part of that day of protest. Hope, realistic or not, abounds at these events. There's a feeling of energy and commitment. New relationships are formed, brave statements are made, dreams take some shape, and substantial change seems possible. I wonder if this version of hope was in the minds of some of the multitude of disciples who followed Jesus into Jerusalem. It was an interesting choice Jesus made to go to Jerusalem during the Feast of the Passover. Passover was not the most celebrated feast in the Second Temple period. However, it could be seen as the most political and even volatile of all the festivals. It was intended to invoke a vibrant remembrance of the liberation of the Hebrews from Egyptian oppression. This was when they recalled how the blood of the lambs on doorposts saves the Hebrew from the death that swept through Egypt. The Passover feast itself served as shorthand for the entire Exodus experience, leaving Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, God's choice of Israel at Sinai, the giving of the covenant commandments, the wandering in the wilderness, and the eventual movement into Canaan. God's triumph over the greatest superpower of the day must have resonated in the minds of the Jews in their Second Temple celebrations of Passover. The political and the revolutionary runs through the entire feast. Perhaps this is why Pontius Pilate and his legions left the safety of his palace in Caesarea Maritima for dusty, dangerous Jerusalem. Emperor Trajan wrote in the second century, "When people gather for a common purpose, they soon become political groups." Put bluntly, his and the Roman Empire understanding of these kinds of gatherings was, give people enough time and space and they will soon turn against you. This same fear was expressed by the Pharisees, who warned Jesus that he must stop all this joyous and boisterous entrance into Jerusalem. Subtext, it's dangerous for us. It could upset things. So it might appear that Jesus was trying to trigger a reaction from the crowds and the political leaders. The timing of his entrance, the curious way the young donkey was procured, and Jesus' comments to the Pharisees that this celebration was inevitable. These very stones would cry out. This has caused some commentators on this passage to wonder if there had been some pre-planning for this triumphant procession. Had the colt's owners been approached and the colt selected long before the disciples led it away? Were the disciples and others told to gather palms? Were some asked to bring extra cloaks to fling down in front of Jesus? Were they instructed to sing this well-known ancient theme of Hosanna as they walked? I wonder. On the other hand, this scene must have been strangely familiar for some. A similar procession is described by the prophet Zechariah. He tells of a messianic figure riding into Jerusalem on a donkey, triumphant and victorious. So when Jesus rode into the city on a donkey, some would have seen it as a prophecy being fulfilled. For others, this action gathered and solidified his preaching and the declaration of who he is. And for some, it signaled political change, freedom for this conquered people. I wonder. Luke, unlike Mark and Matthew and John, does not emphasize the political significance of Jesus' final trip to Jerusalem. And again, I wonder why. It has been said that Luke preferred to write about a Jesus who offered peace. Perhaps. I don't know. But I do know this, that there are times when compassionate faith and following prophecies and hopeful protests are two sides of the same coin. I'm intrigued by the multitude of disciples and crowds. We know that Pontius Pilate and his entourage were coming into Jerusalem at the same time as Jesus. This popular prophet, member of an unruly and difficult conquered people, riding on a donkey, heralded by crowds, called king, and Pilate on the other side, his armor-covered horse, encircled by well-armed guards, enters into the city quickly, fearfully feared and unwelcome. We know they meet later, but for now, the contrast between power and privilege at one gate and humility and welcome on the other is stark. There is joyous hope as the people celebrate Jesus' arrival. Whereas for Pilate and his soldiers, there is frustration at the political situation and fear of what might happen next. As time progresses, people who have cheered, those who have stood back because of their concerns about this unwise action, the ones who were caught up in the radical actions, the ones who recognized and remembered Zechariah's prophecy, I wonder where they will be in the following days. What actions will they take when there is no longer a joyful crowd nor any news of a planned political coup? We have come through the gate from Lent, and now we enter into the deep solemnity of Holy Week. It's unwise to see this journey to the cross only as a powerful and difficult divine mystery. I believe that as we listen to the gospel narrative of the Passion, we are called to know more deeply that following the road to the cross and beyond is a call to action. We too may be called to shout hosannas. We may be called to acknowledge and support the condemned Jesus. And as the light fades from his eyes on the cross, we must be prepared to nurture the mourners, to wait with the women, to hold Mary as she weeps, to sit at the fire with the soldiers and proclaim, yes, we do know him. We may be called to go into the crowds, not to hide, but to proclaim the radical story of hope and love. We may be called to challenge the institutions that promote fear and injustice. We ultimately will be called to act outside of the boundaries of proper behavior. Jesus' entrance into Jerusalem was a taste of hope and possibilities. The boisterous hosannas, the singing, the young donkey bearing its holy cargo, the flinging down of cloaks, were all acts of protest and hope.